All right, so this is Bio 241. This is our second meeting, and it's the Monday-Wednesday class, and it is January 14th. We got to finish up chapter 1, but somebody had a question. How do you find the lecture recordings? All right, so I tell you what, I'm going to stop the slideshow, go back to the internet browser right here. And it is on my website by Cypress College. And I don't have it in this as a... Yeah, that's it. Was it on there? Ah, yeah, it is right there. Thank you. Okay. So this is the URL. Not www, but SEM, standing for Science, Engineering, Math. That's the division. CypressCollege.edu, then... If an instructor has a website in this division, it's going to be tilde and then the letter of their, the initial of their first name and then their full last name. And then you should go to be directed to that website. So we're interested in something that looks like 241, I think. Yeah, 241 lectures. So click on this link. And this is where the lecture recordings are going to be. So you're going to be under Monday, Wednesday. There's going to be Tuesday, Thursday under this one, so click here. And these are all the lectures from last semester. I haven't uploaded any lectures from this semester yet, but I usually do that at the end of the week, like on Friday, certainly before Sunday, but maybe Saturday morning. All right, so somewhere along that time. So you see two different icons here. One is the audio file, which is a WAV file, which means then you can right-click, save target as, download it to your computer, and then once in your computer, you can listen to it if you have speakers or headphones, or you can copy it to your MP3 player, PDA, or burn it to a CD, play it in your car, whatever you might find useful, if you find that information handy. Some people do, and other people, it just doesn't resonate, doesn't help them learn anything. So it all depends on you. And this other icon, what does this icon look like? Microsoft Word document. So this is a text file. It's a transcript of the audio. So if you have a hearing deficit, for instance, you can read what was going on in the lecture, or if you want to look at spelling, for instance, it might be spelled correctly in here. So this was from the first day of fall semester, August 18th. Okay. The transcripts are all from a previous year. They're not going to be an exact transcript of what happened this year, but the content is going to be the same. All right, so if in the transcript you read that you have a test on August 23rd, please realize that that doesn't correspond to this class, okay, because we're not meeting in August. Okay, but the WAV file should correspond. So I'll leave these up maybe through the weekend, but in case you want to download them and archive them for your own purposes, but after this weekend I'm going to delete all the WAV files. I'll keep the text files because I'll need those this semester too. Okay? All right, so that's where you find it. SEMcypresscollege.edu tilde J. Gober. Okay? And that's the link that's in my contact information in the syllabus. You just have to know how to mouse to it to get to it. Any questions on that? Okay. All right, so we're going to finish up chapter 1. What was the most important concept in chapter 1? Homeostasis. That's right, we looked at scientific method a little bit, to give you a feel for the scientific method. But what's the take-home message with scientific method? Why do we go through all those machinations, all those steps for scientific method? To get dependable information, right? To get accurate information that we can trust our lives to, right? So that's the purpose of the scientific method. And then the other thing is you should probably appreciate the difference between a hypothesis and a theory. Which one has more credence? Which one is more valuable? Theory. Yeah, theory, because it's backed up by scientific evidence, right? Okay. All right, so let's just review homeostasis, and the way homeostasis is maintained in our bodies is through response loops. So this diagram right here just should be burned into your memory. These are all the steps of a response loop. So you should know each one of those divisions right there, and you should know, for instance, where the set point is located. Where's the set point located? Integration center. What good is a set point? What do you use a set point for? Yeah, it's a baseline measurement. That's what your body should be at. So the integration center won't know if there is an error taking place in your body unless it knows what the proper value should be. So the set point is the proper value, and the integration center gets information from a sensor or a receptor, and it compares what's happening in your body with what the set point is, and then it makes a decision on what to do to get that parameter back to the set point. All right, so the end product of a response loop is actually a response. All right, here's a response. Oh, okay. I know what I got to do to get my cursor. So I'll go back to this. All right, so this is the product of a response loop. That's the response. And response is always going to influence the stimulus. It can influence it in two ways. What are the two ways that a response can influence the stimulus? It can add to it or subtract from it. If it adds to it, what kind of response loop is that? What kind of feedback is it? Okay, that's positive feedback. And is that a normal, healthy situation? No, because when response adds to the stimulus, that moves the system farther and farther away from the set point. But if the response subtracts from the stimulus, we call that negative feedback, that drives this parameter back to the set point or to that normal value. Okay, so that's how you should think of a response loop. And we looked at a couple hypothetical situations. All right, and I don't think we got to this slide right here, which is just a short discussion on some positive feedback response loops. There are not many of them that are normal. Most positive response loops produce pathology or even death when they occur in somebody. But here are three that occur all the time that are normal. All right? It's involved with producing blood clots, because when one aspect of a positive feedback loop, it is something that can happen very quickly. A response can build up very, very fast because it adds to the stimulus. So, for instance, when you cut a blood vessel, that fluid is just going, and if it's an artery, it's going to gush out of that blood vessel. You're going to lose a massive amount of blood. And so that injury to the blood vessel should be stopped up as fast as possible. And so coagulation or blood clotting usually uses some positive feedback mechanisms in the area of the injury to that blood vessel, not all over your body, but just in that area, that produces a blood clot very, very rapidly to prevent blood loss. All right, that's one situation. Another situation would be when a female ovulates an egg from an ovary. There is a hormone called luteinizing hormone, which then causes the ovary to secrete chemicals, which causes a further increase in luteinizing hormone, which causes the ovary to further increase the level of luteinizing hormone from the pituitary gland. And the response adds to the stimulus. There's a huge spike in luteinizing hormone, and eventually what happens is that an egg is ovulated from an ovary in a fairly violent kind of reaction, but at least it's released from the ovary for fertilization to take place. Okay, and the last one, okay, positive feedback between the uterus and the fetus during parturition. So this sort of works where as the fetus is developing in utero, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. All right, when it's really small, it has a lot of room to run around and play soccer and stuff like that, right? All right, but as it gets bigger, how does it feel? It gets confined, right? It doesn't have as much room to run around in there. And as it becomes confined, as it grows bigger and bigger, its stress level increases, and it releases stress hormones. And those stress hormones then triggers the release of oxytocin from the mother. And oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant, and it causes a contraction of the uterus. All right, so what's the effect on the fetus then as the uterus starts to contract? Okay, it moves, but it feels even more confined. Its stress level increases. It releases stress hormones, which cause the release of more oxytocin. All right, so that's a positive feedback mechanism where oxytocin creates more stress. More stress causes the release of more oxytocin, which creates more stress, which releases more oxytocin. All right, so you might be kind of asking, well, you know, how come the whole world isn't filled with stress and oxytocin? What happens to stop that positive feedback cycle from happening? Yeah, the baby is born, right? Okay, and then that cycle is reset. So at the end of every positive feedback cycle, there is something dramatic, catastrophic happening. All right, and in these particular cases, it's a normal everyday occurrence, but if it happens in other kinds of systems that usually rely on negative feedback to maintain health, the result of positive feedback mechanism is death or disease, right? These are only a couple others. Another one that actually involves oxytocin is the milk letdown reflex. That's due to positive feedback as well. And that's when a mother is nursing their infant. Okay, so when an infant starts to nurse or suckle on the breast, how that causes the release of oxytocin. Okay, that causes contraction of smooth muscle of the breast. That causes milk letdown or the secretion of milk from the breast. And what does the infant do? Does it become bored or what? It is stimulated, so it suckles more, which causes more stimulation, release of oxytocin, so the infant nurses more and more and more. That causes more release of milk letdown. Okay, so that's another positive feedback cycle. But can that go on forever? How come we're not all filled up with breast milk in this room? Something drastic happens. Well, the breast just runs out of milk. Okay, when the breast runs out of milk to supply that infant, what happens to the infant? It becomes disinterested, falls asleep. Okay, so that positive feedback cycle kind of ends in a nice gentle way. Okay. All right, so that's positive feedback. Not many naturally occurring. Here's another example of how the examples that I worked up for you for lab are probably a little bit better and a little bit more sophisticated, but we can go over this pretty quickly. For instance, we can think of one parameter that is control, and that is blood pressure. When a person is lying down and they change body position to standing up, you'll have a transient decrease in blood pressure. Your blood pressure is going to decrease just due to a change in body position. Okay. And if your blood pressure doesn't adjust when you go from lying down to standing up, some people can even pass out. We call that orthostatic hypotension. All right, and that's not necessarily a good thing, because if you're standing up and you pass out, well, you're going to hit your head on the table, and then it's going to bounce off that and maybe hit a chair and bounce off that and hit the floor, and it's going to be a nasty situation. So you don't want to pass out when you stand up. All right, so the stimulus, what's the stimulus here? Going from lying down to standing up is going to be a decrease in blood pressure. And how does your body monitor a decrease in blood pressure? What does it have to have? It's got to have a sensor or a receptor. Do you know the name of a receptor that does that? The baroreceptor. Yeah, you should be familiar with that. So baroreceptors in the arch of the aorta, carotid sinus, measure that pressure going down. The afferent pathway is the glossopharyngeal nerve, or the vagus nerve, depending on where it comes from. And it goes to the integration center. Where's the integration center for this particular feedback loop? The medulla oblongata, the cardioregulatory center. All right. So there's a decrease in blood pressure. Here are the receptors, the baroreceptors, that's the sensor. And here's the afferent pathway. Oh, there's the answer to my questions already right here. All right, the medulla oblongata. All right, that's the integration center. What does that integration center have? The set point. It has normal blood pressure. But it's seeing, oh, well, blood pressure is decreasing, and it probably knows you're going to pass out. So what's the decision of the cardioregulatory center going to be? To decrease your blood pressure or increase it? Increase it back to the set point. And in the slides that you have from lab, you see a number of ways that it can do that. But one of the ways, it's going to go to the heart, and it's going to increase heart rate, and it's going to increase force of contraction of the heart. So this is the effector, and as the heart rate increases, when we get to the cardiovascular system, this will be really obvious to you, as heart rate increases and the force of contraction increases, blood pressure goes back up. That's the response. So the response is an increase in blood pressure. The stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. So what kind of feedback loop is being used here when the response subtracts from the stimulus? Negative feedback, and that produces a normal, healthy, disease-free state. Okay? Okay. So So that's that one. So don't forget that integration center has the set point and then makes a decision on what to do. Blood glucose levels is under homeostatic control as well. When you eat something, there is glucose in the food you eat. You absorb it from your digestive tract, and it enters your circulatory system. Your blood glucose increases. All right? Too much is not good, especially over the long term. Produces a lot of cardiovascular disease, coma, etc., etc. Even in the short term, it's not good. All right? So there is a sensor that can monitor blood glucose, and that's in the pancreas. There are cells that can measure glucose. They have receptors for glucose. And they're in a part of the pancreas called the islets of Langerhans. Probably this is just a little review from anatomy for you. Is this anatomy? No, this isn't anatomy. This is physiology class. Okay. Okay. And as a result, these cells are going to release insulin. Insulin is a passport that glucose needs to enter cells. Most cells of your body, glucose cannot enter it without this particular passport. So when insulin increases in the blood, most of the cells in your body can take up glucose. And as the cells are taking glucose up from the blood, what happens to the amount of glucose that is in the blood? It's got to go down, right? So it can't stay high in the blood and go up higher in the cells. If the cells get it from someplace, they get it from the blood, so blood glucose concentration goes down. So that is the response, a decreased blood glucose. And how does that relate to the initial stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from it? It subtracts, because the initial stimulus was an increase, the response is a decrease. This is a nice negative feedback loop. Okay, keeping blood glucose within normal limits. And remember, that's the whole job of homeostasis. The job of homeostasis is not to make sure that everything is absolutely constant. The job of homeostasis is to allow things to move around, increase and decrease, so that they don't go beyond the normal limits. Everything is supposed to vary a little bit. Body temperature varies a little bit. Water balance, right? Glucose concentration, hormone levels go up and down, but not so much that it causes a disease state. Okay, so again, when you think of homeostasis, how do I think of homeostasis? What's the one word that I use? Okay, dynamic constancy, that's two words. Okay, that's what a lot of really sophisticated people say. But I just think about it in much more simple terms. I think about it as a dance. Right, because pH is changing, temperature is changing, hormone levels are changing, right? But they're not changing very much. They're just all changing to maintain a healthy state inside your body. And that's where that dynamic constancy term comes from. It sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook to me because it's opposite terms being put together. But homeostasis means maintaining a little bit of constancy, but within that realm, things can change a little bit. And it is dynamic, okay? It is a dance, yeah. Yeah, that cell has the receptor, and it's the integration center and everything all in one piece.
So,
yeah.
So like the pancreatic insulin will be the integration center plus the sensor.
Yeah, it's got everything. Yeah. Okay. There's another hormone involved in regulating blood glucose, and that is glucagon. That's what we see on the right-hand slide over here. All right, so when you're eating, blood glucose goes up. But when you're fasting, what happens to your blood glucose? It goes down, right? Because you're not absorbing glucose from your gastrointestinal tract. But nonetheless, you still should maintain blood glucose. Otherwise, you're going to pass out, right? You're going to go into a coma. All right, so where do you get glucose from when you're in a fasted state, like first thing in the morning after not eating all night long? Unless you get up in the middle of the night. Well, the pancreas, again, has those receptor cells. There's another cell that can measure, another kind of cell that measures glucose. And when glucose levels in the blood decrease, those other cells of the pancreas release glucagon. Maybe you haven't heard of glucagon. But its effect is completely different, 180 degrees different than insulin. Glucagon goes to the liver. And the liver has a compound called glycogen. And glycogen is a storage form of glucose. So So glucose is just one little chemical, and we can add two glucoses together to get a little bit more complicated disaccharide. We can put three glucoses together and get a trisaccharide. Or we can put thousands of glucose molecules together to get glycogen. All right, so the basic building block of glycogen is glucose. That's stored in the liver and some other cells, but primarily in the liver. Glucagon tells the liver to find glucagon and chop off one glucose molecule and put it in the blood. Okay, and if blood glucose is still low, glycogen is going to tell the liver to chop off another molecule and put it in the blood. Until, the set point is reached, and then the pancreas is going to stop secreting glucagon. All right, so when glucose in the blood is low, we don't need insulin because insulin is going to decrease it further, right? It's going to let cells take it up. Insulin secretion decreases, glucagon secretion increases. That stimulates the liver to release glucose into the blood, so blood glucose concentration goes up as a result of that. So that's the response. So the effector right here would be the liver. The response is an increase. We see that it subtracts from the stimulus, so that's another nice negative feedback mechanism that maintains glucose within that normal range. Okay? All right, so that's the last slide on chapter one. So any questions about homeostasis? And I think you have to really kind of think about that homeostasis because it's not maybe just as obvious as you think it is. That's why they use that term dynamic constancy, which is weird. Okay, so all right. So did anybody find chapter two? Slides. Wonderful. Okay. So Friday and over the weekend, I'll work on chapter three. Okay, I was kind of taken by surprise that we actually had to change books so close to the beginning of the semester, so I'm catching up as we go in the class, and then over the weekend I'll get the study guide to you as well for that first test, which tells you exactly what exam figures you have to know and end of chapter questions and the questions on the web as well. Okay. All right, so this is a really fun chapter. This is chemistry. All right, this actually, and maybe you don't appreciate that just yet, but chemistry is really the basis of all clinical medicine, right? So this is going to explain how things really work in your body. So you really got to pay attention to this. I think maybe this is the hardest part of the class because this is the most abstract. None of you have ever seen a chemical before, but we're going to talk about chemistry and become a little bit more familiar with it. If you have a background in chemistry, you might know all this stuff already. And you might do really good on the exam that's coming up because there's going to be some chemistry on that exam. But don't forget for the second exam, right, if you're a chemist, on the second exam, you're not so familiar with that material. So don't study the same amount for the second exam as the first one if you're an expert in chemistry. That's happened to a couple students. Right, I've had chemistry students come to the first part of the class and say, oh, well, this class is really easy. And then they don't study for the second test, and the second test is not chemistry. And they bomb the second test. So you got to keep applying yourself, okay? And you have to change how you apply yourself depending on your background. All right, so in this chapter, I tell you what, when are we going to stop in here? We go from what, 3 to 4:20, okay. Okay, so chemistry. In this chapter, we're going to talk about atoms. All right, we're going to learn something about how molecules are put together. They're put together via chemical bonds. There are various kinds of chemical bonds, and it's important because that's going to affect our physiology depending on what kind of chemical bond is involved. We're going to talk about acids and bases. All right, we have to know why a compound is an acid, why it is a base, and something about the pH scale. pH is a measure of acidity of an aqueous solution. Okay, it's got to be a water solution. So, for instance, butter is not an aqueous solution. It's not water. It doesn't have a pH. Right? It's only something that has water in it that can have pH. And then we're going to talk about the four different kinds of organic molecules. Actually, a good way of talking about this, the four kinds of biological molecules in our body, and indeed they are all organic, but we have a lot of organic molecules that are not in our body, and there are important molecules that are in our body that are not organic, and we'll try to appreciate those distinctions. Okay, so an atom. Let's start with an atom. Atom is the smallest structure of matter. Matter is really anything that can occupy space, like the tabletop, your pen, even the gas that's in the air around us is made up of matter, which is made up of atoms. And we can decompose an atom into even smaller pieces, right? So in order to understand some other chemical principles, we'll have to know something about subatomic particles. Not a whole lot, but a couple things. There are three subatomic particles that we're interested in. We're interested in something called a proton, something called an electron, and something called a neutron. Some of these particles are electrical in nature. They have an electrical charge, and one doesn't. The one that has a positive charge is called a proton. One that has a negative charge is called an electron. And the particle that has no charge whatsoever is called a neutron. Okay, and not only do they have or not have a charge, they have a location where they can exist within an atom. And the model or the way that we're going to think about an atom is based on a solar system model. So, when we think of our solar system, where we live, what's in the center of our solar system? The sun. And we're a planet that's in orbit around the sun, right? It's just kind of circling the sun. All right, so in the center of an atom, we call this the nucleus. That would be like our sun in our solar system. And inside the nucleus, we can have protons and neutrons. Right, so protons and neutrons are inside the nucleus. And then the planets, we say planets are in orbitals. And that's where electrons can exist, in orbitals. And sometimes we might want to call that a shell because it surrounds the nucleus. And these electrons are whipping around all over the place. And on this diagram, we see them as nice circles. In reality, they're not really nice circles like that, but it's okay for this class, all right? Okay. So there are different kinds. Oops, I guess I switched sides right here. Right. All right, well, I talked about all that already. So you got protons, neutron, electron. I could ask you on a test, where do you find a neutron? In the nucleus, okay? So physiology class is a lot like an anatomy class because in anatomy, you might have a term, for instance, sinus. And a sinus can mean different things depending on where it is in the body. There are sinuses in the liver that allow blood to flow through. There are sinuses right in, for instance, your frontal bone, the paranasal sinus. There's a sagittal sinus, which is a big vein in your brain, right? So people use sinus, but it has different meanings depending on the particular application. The same thing for nucleus. Right? Nucleus has different meanings depending on where it is. The nucleus is that structure inside the cell that contains DNA, genetic information. The nucleus is also the center of this atom right here. It has nothing to do with the nucleus inside of a cell, right? And in anatomy, you also learned of nuclei inside the brain. That's gray matter, collections of nerve cell bodies deep inside the brain. That's a nucleus as well. All right? So you got to be aware that nucleus right here, in terms of atomic theory, is where we find neutrons and protons. Okay. Well, we have different kinds of elements. Let's see if that's what we're going to talk about next. Yeah, different kinds of elements. You've heard of oxygen. What else have you heard of as being an element, a kind of matter? Nitrogen, phosphorus. What do we need to make water besides oxygen? Hydrogen, and you've heard of H2O, so you need two hydrogen molecules and an oxygen to make water. We'll build a water molecule, or I'll have you do it as a homework assignment or something. Okay, but the question today right now is, what's the difference between oxygen and hydrogen? Or what's the difference between nitrogen and phosphorus? Okay, you know, and it's not really the charge. It's something really simple, though. Okay, and the difference between different elements is just simply the number of protons inside the nucleus. That's all there's to it. So if there is one proton inside the nucleus, it's got to be hydrogen element. Okay, and if there's two, there's another one. If there's three, it's another kind of element. And in class, right here, we have these definitions. All right, and it's on a periodic table. Here's a periodic table that shows what elements have how many protons in it. So here is H for hydrogen. You have a table in your notes that tell you which elements you have to know by their chemical symbol. You don't have to know the whole periodic table. You don't have to know that Ru stands for ruthenium. You don't have to know that. Where's another one that I like a lot? You don't have to know... all right, I'll find it in just a second. Okay. I don't know where it is. Okay. But things that are common in the body that relate to physiology, you do have to know. Like hydrogen, that's important. Sodium is important. Yeah, somebody said carbon. Carbon is real important. Okay. Yeah, carbon is real important. Nitrogen, oxygen. All right, so I have a table in your notes. Sometimes it's a little confusing because, for instance, you probably wouldn't have guessed that the symbol for sodium is Na, because sodium starts with an S in English, but that's not how the periodic table got started. It got started in Greek, okay? And in Greek, sodium is natrium, so that's Na. All right, and potassium, that's real important in our bodies. That's kalium. All right, so you don't have to learn that language. You should just memorize these symbols, and the table is in your notes. Okay, so hydrogen has one proton. The next element that has two is helium. Where are those protons located? Inside the nucleus of an atom. And then lithium has got three. Beryllium has got four. Right? Carbon has got six protons inside the nucleus. So different elements have different numbers of protons inside the nucleus. That's all there's to it. So on a test, I might ask you, for instance, iron. How many protons does iron have inside the nucleus? But I'm going to give you a periodic table. I'm going to cover this one up because on this one, you have the chemical symbol and the name. And I need to test you for the name. So I'm going to give you a periodic table with the names erased off of them. So you got to know carbon is carbon. I mean, C is carbon, right? N is nitrogen, plus some others. For instance, like iron. What's iron? Tricky one. Fe, right? Okay, for barium, all right? But iodine is also important in our bodies. What's its chemical symbol? It's I, all right? So there are maybe 10 or 15 symbols that you have to know the names of. And then if you know how to use the periodic table, you can tell me how many protons are inside the nucleus, and what that really is the atomic number. Atomic number defines the element, okay? And so how do you know? Well, you see this one right here? That's the atomic number. That's how many protons inside the nucleus. So what's the atomic number for potassium? 19. Yeah. Okay. So that's how you read the periodic table. And the more you study that, it's going to make really nice sense to you if you ever take a chemistry class, why it's arranged that way. You might kind of see a little bit why it's arranged that way in just a little bit. Okay. Well, electrical charges in nature like to attract each other. Okay, like charges repel each other. So if we have two electrical charges, they repel each other. If you have a positive charge and a negative charge, they will attract each other. And what's going to be the overall charge? If you have one positive and one negative coming together, you got? Okay, you actually have a neutral. They cancel each other out. It becomes neutral. And that's the most stable state in nature, neutrality. That's why opposite charges attract in terms of these electrical particles. All right, so the most stable condition for, say, oh, I see six protons right here, so that's got to be carbon. All right, so in order for carbon to be neutral, because that's the most stable state, how many electrons should a carbon atom have? It should have six, right? Because six protons, six electrons, it's going to be neutral. So we got six protons inside the nucleus. It just so happens that we have six neutrons inside the nucleus. That's some nuclear physics that we're not going to go into, but I think you get a little bit of a feel. If we stick six protons inside the nucleus, what did we say about like charges? They like to repel each other. Well, the only way that nature can stick all those six positive charges inside the nucleus and have them behave is to stick some neutrons in there so that the nucleus just doesn't fly apart. That's what the job of those neutrons are. That's not really important for physiology. Okay. And different isotopes can have different numbers of neutrons inside the nucleus, but it's still the same element if it has the same number of protons inside the nucleus. So I'm not really so concerned about neutrons, except you should know where they are. Where are neutrons located? In the nucleus, right. Okay. So if it's carbon with six protons, it should have, we said, six electrons. And electrons are, where are electrons put? In orbitals or shells. The first shell can only accept two electrons. All right, so this is the lowest level, lowest energy level of all atoms, only two electrons. And then we have to put electrons in the next higher level shell or orbital. So how many electrons are left? If we put two in the first shell, there are four, right? We start with six, there's four left over, so we put four in this outer shell right here. Now maybe you could see the kind of the structure of the periodic table a little bit. In the first shell, how many electrons are there? There are two. So in this first row of the periodic table, what do you see? You just see two elements corresponding to that first shell. All right, so the number of elements corresponds to some interesting structure of shells in an atom, but we're not so concerned about that in this class. All right, so what's the overall charge of this atom if it's got six protons and six electrons? It's neutral. Okay, that's what I want you to know. Okay, let me just kind of look over this slide. Electron shells or orbitals are in layers around the nucleus. Oh, let me go back. The first shell can only take two. All right, and I didn't tell you this. In the next shell, all right, you can put more than two. Okay, and as a matter of fact, okay, the maximum number now goes from two to eight. Okay, you can put eight, but we can't put eight on this one because carbon only has six altogether, right? Okay. All right, so we could put four more. But for instance, if we put four more electrons in this outer shell, which is possible, what would be the overall charge on this carbon atom?
Negative.
Yeah, it'd be negative how much?
Four.
Be negative four. If we put four more electrons to fill this outer shell all the way up, okay, it would be a minus four. And we would call that an ion. Has anybody ever heard of an ion before? Maybe. But that's how ions develop. All right. We're going to see how we can develop some stable ions in just a second. All right. So the first shell, only two electrons. The second shell can take up to eight. Electrons in more distant shells have, higher energy. I should delete that. That's not important for this class. Okay. The electrons in the outermost shell, this is important, are what we call valence electrons. The electrons in the outermost shell can undergo chemical reactions. So where were those at? Right here. These are the electrons that interact with other atoms to cause chemistry to take place. So these are the electrons that we're most interested in. The ones in the valence shell or the outermost shell. Yeah. That's right, there's only four on this one right here. Yeah. Okay. And when there's a chemical reaction, there is the formation or breaking of chemical bonds. So we're going to look at and analyze chemical bonds. So if we're interested in chemical bonds, what are we really interested in looking at? The valence electrons. What are they doing? Are they staying there? Are they hopping from one atom to another? Or what's going on with those valence electrons? Those are the ones that participate in chemistry. Okay. And isotopes, I just kind of mentioned, is when an element contains a different number of neutrons inside the nucleus. Okay, for instance, what's this molecule right here? H2O, that's water. How many protons are inside the nucleus of this hydrogen? Yeah, just one, okay? And every once in a while, there might be a proton, right? And they might, for instance, put a couple neutrons in there. So this is the nucleus, and in the orbital, it's got one electron. So I see one proton, but two neutrons. What is the chemical element here? Okay, no, just the name of the element. Is this carbon? Is this fluorine or sodium, potassium, or what? Okay. It's hydrogen because it has one proton. But it has an odd number of neutrons, right? So it's got two. This is what we call deuterium. Okay, so deuterium is like hydrogen, except it's got what? It's a different isotope. It has a different number of neutrons in there. And isotopes sometimes are not stable. They're radioactive, and they can be used for medical imaging purposes. Okay, so here is the table that is in the study guide. These are the elements that you have to know, their name and their chemical symbol. So you got to memorize column 1 and column 2. Column 3 you don't have to memorize, but it's interesting to see what percentage these various elements participate in your body and physiology. And you need some really strange ones, right? Like chromium, you need some cobalt, you need some copper to facilitate certain kinds of chemical reactions that we're going to talk about. Right, so make sure you know that Cu stands for copper, Co, right, is not copper, but it is cobalt, okay. Vitamin B12, cobalamin requires cobalt in order to work properly, okay. So, can you all see these two columns? Got to make sure you know Na stands for sodium, right, okay. So you can memorize that a little bit. All right, so let's talk about chemical bonds, and when we're interested in chemical bonds, what are we really going to be looking at?
Valence.
The valence electrons. That's right, the valence electrons. All right, so molecules form by chemical bonding between valence electrons of atoms. Number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete an outermost shell of an atom. Okay, so for this innermost shell, what was the maximum number of electrons that we can put in this first shell right here?
Two.
Two, right. Okay, and we said that this atom is neutral if the number of protons is equal to the number of electrons, right? So if we have, so what element is this right here?
Hydrogen.
That's hydrogen. It just has that one proton in there. So it's neutral when it has one electron, but you know what? It's not stable when it has one electron in the outer shell because there really should be two, right? So if there are two electrons in this outer shell, it's stable, but it's going to have a net negative charge, all right? So again, it's not going to be stable because it's an ion. All right, so there is a circumstance that can happen where if we put two hydrogen atoms together, they can combine and these outer shells can overlap, and this hydrogen atom now feels like it has two electrons in its outer shell, feeling very comfortable and stable. And this hydrogen atom feels very comfortable and stable because it feels like it has these two electrons in its outer shell. But if we look at the overall charge of this molecule right here, so molecules is when we put more than one atom, two or more atoms together, that's a molecule. So this, what is the overall charge of this molecule? It is plus two, right? Minus two, it is neutral. So here's a funny kind of circumstance where electrons are shared, so two atoms feel as if their outermost shell is completely filled with electrons. And if we look at the overall charge, it is neutral. All right, so that is a covalent bond. So the key term for covalent bond is what? The sharing of electrons. So that's the key term. When electrons are shared between neighboring atoms in a molecule, that's a covalent bond. And different kinds of bonds have different strengths. A covalent bond is the strongest kind of bond that we're going to look at in here. So if you want to put something together but have the ability to take it apart again at a moment's notice, would you want to use a covalent bond?
No,
because once you put them together, they're going to be stuck together, okay, until you come up with a more drastic process to take them apart, okay? Yeah, I think I saw a question. Oh, on the periodic table right here? Are you interested in this? In the notes? The table that has the chemical symbol? No, because I'm going to give you a periodic table. So a question might be, what's the atomic number of, what are one of these things you have to know? You got to know cobalt. And what's the chemical symbol for cobalt? You'll learn that from the table, that's Co. I'm going to give you this with the name erased, but the question will be, what's the atomic number for cobalt? And with the periodic table that I give you, you're going to see, here's cobalt. The atomic number is 27 right there. Okay? So that's not too bad. It just gives you a little familiarity with the periodic table, but you got to definitely memorize the chemical symbol and its English name. Okay? Yeah.
Do we have
an
atomic mass, too?
No. And what is atomic number? You should be familiar with the concept of atomic number. What's atomic number? Just the number of protons inside the nucleus that determines the kind of element that it is. Right? Okay. But that also determines how many electrons there will be in orbitals to make it electrically neutral, right? So if it's carbon with six protons inside the nucleus, in order for a carbon atom to be neutral, it's got to have six electrons, right? But there is another feature that promotes stability, and that is compounds are most stable, or atoms are most stable, when their outermost shell is completely filled with electrons. And this is a stable molecule because how many electrons can we put in the first shell? Only two. And when it's filled up, it becomes stable. Okay? Okay. All right, so that's the basis of a covalent bond. It's the strongest kind of bond. And we say it is nonpolar if these two atoms share these electrons equally. Some atoms, when they're put together, don't share them. Some actually kind of steal them more than the other atom. And the ones that like to steal electrons are, for instance, oxygen and phosphorus and nitrogen. Those would be forming polar covalent bonds. I'll talk about that some more in just a little bit. Let's see what my next slide is. Ah, right here. That's a good one. All right, well, let's maybe quickly, just so that you can see this concept, let's build a water molecule, okay, real quick, to see how covalent bonds develop. So we've got an oxygen. How many protons inside an oxygen? Where would you try to find that out? You can memorize it, but good God, I would never do that. I would look at a periodic table, okay? What's the chemical symbol for oxygen? Oh, and so what's the atomic number? Can you see the number there? 8. All right, so here's an oxygen that's got 8. All right, so where can we put these 8 electrons in order for that oxygen to be neutral? Can we put them all in the first shell? No, can't do that. All right, so here is the first shell. How many can you put in the first shell? Only 2. We got to put some more then where? In the outer shell. And we got 6 of them, so we could do 1, 2, 3, 4. All right, 1, 2, 3, 4. But we got to figure out a place to put 2 more, right? Let's put maybe here and here. All right, so is that 8 altogether? 2, 4, 6, 8. All right, but is this oxygen completely stable? No, because it wants to have 8 electrons in this outer shell, in the valence shell right here. So it's going to be looking over the whole universe for 2 more electrons. All right, now what atom wants to share some electrons? One electron in particular. How about that hydrogen? So here we have a hydrogen with 1 proton inside the nucleus. The first shell is going to have how many electrons in it? It's going to have 1 electron, all right? And if it overlaps just right, okay, it's going to, all right, let me put it in the middle, it's going to share its electron with oxygen, helping fill up this shell. The other electron from oxygen is going to be shared with this proton, going to fill up the valence shell in this proton, and then over here, there can be another, what chemical element is that? Hydrogen again, it has only 1 electron, okay, which is going to be shared with this oxygen. So now the oxygen feels like it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 electrons in its valence shell. The hydrogens feel like it's got 2, and so we've just built a water molecule, okay, using this valence theory. And what's the overall charge on this molecule? It's got 10 protons, 10 electrons, it's neutral. Water is neutral if you look at it from far away. But oxygen is one of those atoms, all right, that's very greedy when it comes to covalent bonds. It likes to take the electrons that other, especially hydrogen, that hydrogen is trying to share with it. All right, so this hydrogen electron is going to be over here more than it's going to wander out over in this region. So if you walk up to a water molecule from this direction, is it going to look neutral? What are you going to see first? You're going to see this proton first before you see all of these electrons. What happens if you walk up on a water molecule from this direction? What are you going to see? All these massive electrons right here. Right? So if you look at a water molecule from this direction, it looks a little positive. If you look at it from over here, it looks a little negative. Okay? And actually the way that these orbitals are set up is that these things are angulated a little bit. So a really nice way of diagramming it, okay, is with this angle between the hydrogen. So these hydrogens look a little what? Positive. And this oxygen over here looks a little negative. If we add up these two extra little positives and this little extra negative, it's neutral. Water is absolutely neutral, but if you get close to it in one of these areas, it's going to have a little charge. And because this end of the molecule is positive and this end is negative, it has two different ends. And when something has two different ends, like our planet, in terms of its magnetic field, what do we call the poles? Well, I'm sorry, I said the word. Okay, it's a polar molecule. If something has two opposite ends, it's polar. It's not the same depending on how you look at it. Okay, so this oxygen is negative, the hydrogen is positive of a water molecule. Okay, so oxygen produces what we call a polar covalent bond. Right, it produces some areas in the molecule that are a little bit positive, and the oxygen is going to be a little bit negative. So it has positive and negative poles. Other elements that produce polar bonds that develop a little electrical charge on them are nitrogen and phosphorus. They strongly pull electrons to them. Right, so they denude this proton of its electrons and make this end of the molecule positive in nature. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. If you were to look at the overall charge on this molecule right here, it's neutral. Water is neutral all by itself. Okay? But if you get really close to it, it's going to have that little bit of an electrical charge, much smaller than the charge on a proton or the charge on an electron, but nonetheless, it's still there. So what can you tell me about electrical charges? The like charges attract or repel each other? Like charges repel, opposite charges attract. So if we put another water molecule in here, how is it going to associate with this first water molecule? Can we put an oxygen here? No, because same charges repel each other. So if we put another water molecule, guess what's going to happen? It's going to associate like this, and then these charges are going to have a tendency to cancel out. So even liquid water, right? There's a lot of structure in liquid water where different parts of a molecule are attracted to each other. This is another kind of bond that we're going to talk about, the last kind of bond we're going to talk about. It's a very, very weak bond, but even liquid water has a lot of structure to it. And a lot of times in physics, we talk about compounds like that. We call those liquid crystals. Right, again, kind of two terms that don't make any sense put together. But water has a lot of structure because of those polar bonds that are made. Okay, this diagram here that I have on the slide shows that water can dissociate. It can break apart. Right, that covalent bond can break, and it can break down into a hydrogen ion right here. The electron from this hydrogen ion ends up on this OH group. So we're left with a 1 plus charge over here and a 1 minus charge on this OH group. All right, so water can break apart, and this is a hydrogen atom minus its electron. What is a hydrogen atom? So here's a hydrogen atom, right? What's a hydrogen atom if we take away its electron? What is it? It's positive. What is this thing called? Okay. I'm going to be using this term. People use this term interchangeably, but if you can see it for the first time and say it, then it'll be easier. You don't have to memorize it so much. So this is a hydrogen atom. If we take away this electron, what is this thing right here? This is the only thing that's left. What do we put inside the nucleus? protons or neutrons, but this one here is a proton. So if we take this electron away, the chemical we have left is just a proton. So a hydrogen ion or a proton are exactly the same thing. Okay, hydrogen ion. So here is a hydrogen ion, but what's a hydrogen ion? It's just a proton that's in space, right? So this is the basis of acidity. This is what we measure with pH, this hydrogen ion or a proton. It's very reactive in terms of chemistry. Okay. And here is that hydroxide ion. Okay. So covalent bonds, these are pretty strong. The next kind of bond, let me see. Okay, next kind of bond is an ionic bond. These are weaker. Not the weakest kind of bond, but these are a lot weaker than covalent bonds. So let's use our orbital theory to figure out how this works. But again, it has to do with what kind of electrons, the valence electrons in the outermost shell. All right, so here we have, I should have adulterated this slide. So what kind of element has 11 protons inside the nucleus? Look at that periodic table over there. Can you find one with 11? Okay, we see sodium right there. And there's a nice 11. Yep. So how do we put these electrons into their shells? The first shell's got two. Okay, so here are two. And then the next shell has got eight. That's 10 electrons, but sodium's got 11, so that means you got one electron left over. Can't go in the second shell. You got to throw it into the third shell, the outermost shell. Here you got one measly, lonely, lousy electron in this outermost shell, highly unstable. Even though electrically this system right here is neutral, the protons equal the number of electrons, it is still not as stable as it could be because on this outermost shell there should be either no electrons or 8 electrons, right? The outermost shell should be completely filled up. So sodium by itself is not very stable, even though it is electrically neutral. It wants to get rid of this electron. It's going to look over the whole universe to find somebody that wants this electron and will gladly get rid of it. And very soon it's going to find an atom that wants to gain an electron. And a good example would be this atom right here, this element that has 17 protons inside the nucleus. Who's that? If you look at the periodic table, right, you see that it's Cl, and then look at your table and your notes, Cl stands for chlorine, right, and it's got 17 electrons. So in the first shell, there's two, eight in the second shell, that's 10 electrons. You're left with 7 electrons, right, in the outermost shell. But how many should there be in this outermost shell? Not 7, there should be 8. So chlorine is looking for an electron. All right, so how's that going to match up with sodium? Perfectly. Sodium wants to get rid of one, chlorine wants to gain one. So this is the basis of an ionic bond. An ionic bond is when one atom donates an electron and another atom accepts. So you should have that terminology on the tip of your tongue. Covalent bonds are doing what with the electrons? Sharing. Ionic bonds, donating and accepting, not sharing. Much more greedy kind of circumstance, right? And you have to match up the elements so that the various atoms can either donate or accept electrons. All right, so when sodium donates an electron, now it has one less electron than it should have, right? And so what's the charge of a sodium? It's got to be positive one because it's booted out one electron someplace. So this is a nice stable ion. Sodium exists as this ion very easily, all by itself, right? It is stable because what can you tell me about its outermost shell right here? It's filled. It's filled with electrons. All right, what about chlorine? It's filled. It's stable. All of its outermost shell has 8 electrons, but what's its overall charge now? It's going to be negative, right? So it's a nice stable ion. An ion is just a chemical compound that has an electrical charge on it. Okay, not a partial electrical charge like water molecule that has a little area of negativity or positivity, but a true overall 1 plus or 1 minus charge. All right, so this is extremely important because we see ions have an electrical charge. Our bodies communicate and control. It controls itself via electrical charges. So our bodies are essentially electrical in nature. All right, it has a lot of electrical properties. We're going to look at these electrical properties based on these sodium and chloride ions and actually other ions that your body has, like calcium, magnesium, and potassium. All right, and you could draw the orbitals out for potassium and see why it forms an ion as well. Okay, so you should see that there are basically two kinds of ions right here. There's one with positive charges, one with negative charges. They have names. And in medicine, we have to balance charges out sometime. Ones with positive charges are called cations. Ones with negative charges are called anions. And I think my organic chemistry teacher drew this out one day for me, and I never forgot it. It's haunted me my whole life. Okay, so here is a, what is this? That's a cat. Okay, cations. All right, so cation is positive. Anion is negative. Furthermore, some ions don't have one charge. Some have two charges on them. All right, so what does mono mean? What does di mean? Two. What does tri mean? Three. All right, so we talk about these valence charges. If it's a monovalent cation, what can you tell me about that ion? Monovalent. One, what kind? Positive. Yeah. If it's a trivalent anion, it has three negative charges, right? And you might be calculating, not in this class, but sometime in your clinical life, you might have to calculate and make sure a patient has the right amount of cations and anions to balance out, because you don't want them to die. Okay, so make sure you know that terminology, cation versus anion, and kind of understand why ions develop. And that's so that outermost shells, the valence shells, can be filled up with electrons. And that's how a chemical becomes the most stable. Okay. Furthermore, if you have a sodium ion here and a chloride ion here, all right, if you have a cation and an anion, what can you tell me about these two compounds? Are they going to repel each other or attract each other? They're going to attract because they have an opposite charge. So sodium chloride, when we take it out of solution, right, it forms a nice crystal, and that's a nice ionic bond. And when we take a salt crystal and put it in water, an ionic bond is so weak that when we put that salt crystal in water, what happens to it? That ionic bond breaks apart. Okay, so ionic bonds are very, very weak as opposed to covalent bonds. When you put something that has a covalent bond in water, it just doesn't dissolve. It doesn't break apart. It doesn't dissociate, for instance, like things that are put together just by ionic bonds. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, is that why ocean tastes salty?
Yeah. An ocean tastes salty because the base solvent is water, and water dissolves sodium chloride very easily. So when rain hits the ground and there's salt in the ground, the sodium chloride breaks apart. It forms these two ions. Furthermore, this might be the next slide. Is it so? Yes. Okay, the reason why sodium and chloride dissolve in water is because of the electrical properties of sodium and chloride and water. So sodium ion by itself has got, what, a plus one charge. And what can you tell me about water? Does water have any charges on it? Overall, it's neutral, but there's one end of the molecule that is what? That is negative. So this end of the water molecule is negative, it's going to attract a sodium, because sodium is positive. That's why sodium dissolves in water, because they have similar natures. They have polar natures. They have electrical natures that complement each other. Chloride will dissolve in water because, right, it won't associate with the oxygen, but it's going to associate with the positive hydrogens that make up water. So water is a fascinating kind of solvent because it's polar, it has these charges, and it will allow things to dissolve into it that have charge on them. But things that don't have a charge can't dissolve in water. Like, give me a substance that you know doesn't dissolve in water. Like butter, right? You drop toast on your pants or something before you go to work. You can't take a wet napkin and clean up that butter on your pants, right? It won't dissolve in the water. And that's because butter is what we call a nonpolar compound. It has no electrical charges on it, and it will just completely ignore water, and water will completely ignore it because it has no charge, electrical charge. So if we were going to break our universe down into two kinds of molecules. We can break it down into polar molecules that have a charge, like water, ions, and other things that have an electrical charge, and nonpolar molecules that don't have any charge. And they're always going to be separate from each other. Okay, so that's the two basic natures in our universe. And I think you can appreciate that, because if you have a salad dressing bottle at home and you pull it out of the refrigerator, what do you got? You got two worlds in there. You got one oil world and you got one water world. Okay, polar compounds are in the water, and other things that dissolve in oil will be in the oil layer. But you don't want to eat it like that, right? You want to do what? You want to shake it up. And then when you put it back in the refrigerator, what do you have to do to get it into those two compartments? Was there somebody in there taking the fat and putting it up here and the water down here, or what happens? It just automatically happens, right? Because of the two natures of those compounds. It automatically separates out. Okay. All right, so ionic bonds. Hydrophilic molecules are soluble. Hydrophilic meaning water-loving. What can you tell me about a hydrophilic molecule in terms of its electrical charge? Yeah, it likes water. It has to have some kind of electrical charge, because water has these little tiny electrical charges on it. So a hydrophilic molecule has got to have a charge or polarity. Because it readily forms these hydration spheres. So here's a hydration sphere. Remember, water is very ordered, even though it's a liquid. And when we put other stuff in there, it forms its own order as well. Okay, glucose and amino acids are polar in nature. So therefore, they dissolve in water very easily. Hydrophobic molecules, on the other hand, don't have any kind of charge on them anywhere whatsoever. They're going to be completely ignorant of water, don't want to associate with water. We call these nonpolar. They cannot form hydration spheres. Therefore, oils, lipids, fats, gasoline, oil, all that kind of stuff just won't dissolve in water. Okay. All right, so we've looked at two kinds of chemical bonds already, covalent and ionic. Which one is the strongest of those two? Covalent. How would you describe a covalent bond? Sharing of electrons. The weaker of those two is the ionic. How would you describe that kind of interaction? Yeah, give and take. I like that, give and take. Donation and exception, accepting of electrons. Yeah, question. Yep. Doesn't dissociate with sodium and chloride, but there are three atoms that produce polar covalent bonds. There are three atoms that take a lot of electrons away from hydrogen when it binds to it. And those three elements are phosphorus, oxygen — ooh, I might have to break open that Coke — and nitrogen. And glucose is loaded with oxygen atoms bound to hydrogen, which you're going to see in just a second, and that produces very polar kinds of bonds. So sugars can dissolve into water very easily because of those polar bonds that it makes. Even though sugar is not an ion, it has a lot of polar bonds on it. Okay. So, yeah, we got to look at the structure of sugars to show you that, okay? All right, so here is the last kind of bond. This is there's another association that we're going to look at called a van der Waals force. You can write that down a little bit later. But the third bond, and the weakest of all the ones that we talked about so far, is called a hydrogen bond. All right, so here is a water molecule. It's not dissociated. It's just a water molecule. Well, one end is a little bit positive, the other end is a little bit negative. And if we put it in with a bunch of other water, it's going to orient itself so that the hydrogen of a neighboring water is going to associate it with the oxygen of its neighbor. And this oxygen is going to associate with the hydrogen of its neighbor, right? And it's going to go on and on and on and on, just like that. So these associations are very, very weak between this hydrogen and this oxygen. That's what we call a hydrogen bond. That's the weakest bond that we've looked at so far. Okay. And so, for instance, you might not be aware of this, but maybe if you've ever taken a hike outside and looked at a little pond or lake or stream or something, there are certain animals that can actually walk on water because they're not heavy enough to break this hydrogen bond right here. The water molecules are stuck to each other, right, that they can actually walk right on the surface of water. So what kind of animals am I talking about? Like little water spiders and insects and things like that. We're too heavy, right? We have enough weight to break those hydrogen bonds and go kaplunk. But those little insects don't weigh enough to break these hydrogen bonds, and they can walk right on the surface of water. And so these hydrogen bonds forming that nice film that the spider can walk on, we call that surface tension. Okay? These water molecules are glued together strong enough to produce what we call surface tension that can be used by certain animals to walk right on water. All right, but these are the weakest kind of bonds. So, for instance, if your body wants to put two molecules together at one time, but be able to take them apart at another time quickly without a lot of rigmarole, what kind of bond do you think your body likes to use? Ionic bond or covalent bonds, right? So maybe some of you are familiar with DNA. DNA has two long strands of molecules, but in your body, they're put together. But in order for your body to use that DNA, it's got to separate the strands. It's got to unzip the DNA molecule. So what your body uses to put them, the two strands together, but yet allow your body to take them apart with ease, you only use hydrogen bonds to put the strands together. They're very easy bonds to break and to make so that you can get at the information in the DNA. We're going to look at that in some detail, probably in this chapter even, or the next one. Okay, so how are you doing on chemical bonds? You got how many to know? You got three. Which one's the strongest? Mm-hmm. And you got ionic and then hydrogen bonds. Yeah, so those are the kinds of things you got to know about. And probably understand a little bit about orbital theory to know why ions develop and that kind of stuff, why covalent bonds develop. Yeah. A hydrogen ion, if it gains an electron, becomes a hydrogen atom and it's neutral. Okay? So if you just have, so this right here has got what? Just a plus one. So here is a hydrogen ion. It's also called a proton. And if we take an electron and stick it in the outer orbital right here, now that's a hydrogen atom. The hydrogen atom is neutral, but the hydrogen ion has a plus one. So you're asking me if you have this thing right here, which is a hydrogen atom, right? Okay, so if we have an oxygen here, that's got what, eight protons? Okay, well, I don't want to add all this up again, but in the outer shell, right over here, there is an electron that is going to be shared with this hydrogen atom. So now the hydrogen feels like it's got this one and this one in its outermost shell. Right? So these are going to come over here, and this one is going to go over here. So now oxygen is going to share this electron, the hydrogen is going to share this one. What do we call it when, what kind of bond is it when electrons are shared? It's a covalent bond. But still, right, this electron came from the neutrality of this nucleus, and this one came to neutralize this one. So overall, it's still neutral. Yeah, if it's like in a water molecule, then this side over here looks a little bit positive. Okay? And that's what causes the polar nature in a water molecule. Okay? Okay. All right, so let's talk about acids and bases for maybe just a little bit. Okay. Okay, here are some examples of acids, some examples of bases. Some of these are important in your body, some are not. So for instance, this one right here, carbonic acid, H2CO3, that's a very important one in your body. We use that all the time. So probably the sooner you associate this name with this chemical formula, the better. And CO3 right here is going to be similar to another compound that you are familiar with inside your body, which is CO2. Okay? So there is an enzyme that interconverts CO2 with this particular acid right here, carbonic acid. We're going to study that reaction a lot. All right? So it's good that you become a little familiar with this. But what the heck is an acid? An acid is anything that can produce hydrogen ions when that compound is put in water. All right, so when we put carbonic acid in water, it dissociates, it releases a hydrogen ion. All right, so what's a hydrogen ion again? It's just a proton that's in solution. And does this thing like to dissolve in water? Yeah, because water is polar in nature and this thing has a charge, so it's going to dissolve in water very easily. Okay, so an acid releases protons in a solution. So an acid is a proton donor. Take a compound, put it in water. If it donates protons to that solution, it's an acid. Okay? So if you have a water molecule, H2O, and it breaks down into a hydrogen ion or a proton, what's left over? All right? So when you break water down, you get what? OH minus. All right? So a base, all right, is something that will lower hydrogen ion levels of a solution, a proton acceptor. So which one of these two chemical compounds can accept a proton to become neutral? It's this OH, right? So if we have an OH plus a proton right here, what are you going to get out of it? Right? You're going to get H2O, which is neutral. So acids can be used to neutralize bases, for instance. So any kind of compound that releases hydroxide ions into solution is what we call a base, because it does what? It neutralizes protons that are in solution. Okay. So that's the basic definition of an acid and a base. And the way that we talk about acidity and alkalinity in a solution is with a quantitative number called pH. I'll just introduce this. All right, the pH is a measure of the concentration of, what is this right here? What's H plus? That's a proton or a hydrogen ion. Okay, so the pH is just a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration. And as the hydrogen ion concentration increases, all right, what can you tell me about the acidity of a solution? As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, the acidity does what? It goes up, right? So acidity is directly related to hydrogen ion concentration. Now here's a strange thing. As the acidity of a solution increases, what about the pH number? The pH number actually goes the opposite way. It goes down. So it's a little confusing, right? As the acidity goes up, the pH number goes down. So if you start with a pH 7, and the pH goes to 1, it's becoming very acidic. Okay, so I'll have to start with a pH scale next time. Don't forget, today's Wednesday. Monday is the next lecture, except what?
Holiday.
It's a holiday. So it's going to be 1 week from today. All right, but watch your emails, because I'm sure I'm going to send you some emails before Wednesday. Okay?